Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, January 28th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the dusterly ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Alex Perrine, the owner of the AP Substack, also staff writer at the New Republic, and host, co-host of the podcast The Politics of Everything. Also on the program today, Biden to name Breyer's successor quickly. But will it be quick enough?
Gotta be quick.
Gotta be quick. Meanwhile, Biden set to speak in Pittsburgh today on the bipartisan infrastructure bill that passed as a bridge collapses and injures 10 in Pittsburgh. Pramila Jayapal calls for passage of Manchin's stripped-down social spending likes, which apparently she is aware of. White House warns Ukraine to get ready as talks with Russia continue. Meanwhile, cancel culture strikes again as a Tennessee school board bans the teaching of the Holocaust novel Mouse.
That's the next step in the anti-CRT push. It's Holocaust now. It's no joke.
Federal judge cancels a huge tranche of oil and gas leases, federal ones sold by the Biden administration. Omicron receding, but still over 2,000 people a day in this country are dying of this so-called mild, cold-like virus. So much so that the White House is now mulling new COVID-related, that means limited, paid leave provisions. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Friday. Emma Vigeland is here, and as Emma can attest to, I am wearing a soft-collared shirt. In fact, yeah, you don't have a collar on that.
No
thing.
Collar.
No collars on.
Oh,
it.
I forgot to wear my popped collar today.
No one else is wearing a collared shirt,
no.
Except for me.
I'm wearing a very fuzzy sweater.
I'm not sure I own a collar.
There we go.
It's like shocking me a little bit, like against the chair. I'm getting some electric shock. Yeah, some static. So if
all right. I thought you were saying like I don't know.
No. Something
like your fashion.
No.
Okay.
It's I'm getting like little zaps. So
I used to wear sweatpants all the time in high school, and I used to have this static spray that you could spray your clothes down, and it would stop the static electricity.
So committed to the sweatpants. You're wearing sweatpants right now. Used to.
I'm not as electrically charged these days.
I can only imagine the level of excitement that you had when you discovered this stuff that would eliminate the electric static from your...
Yeah, it's technology.
You're magnetized now, so maybe that's what's eliminating that static.
You know how people
COVID vaccine.
Sometimes they're like, what if you had the ability to travel back in time? Who would you have dinner with? And for me, I think I probably would just want to follow Matt for a day when he was in high school. I just really...
You follow me into my basement where I listen
just
to...
Just want to just see like what it's like, Matt, going...
radio. Sports
Matt,
radio.
Driving across in North Dakota, I had to pick up I had to get that spray, so it took me an hour and a half to drive.
What's sports talk radio like in North Dakota? Because in New York, it's pretty pretty bad, like kind of right-wing pipeline-y. I can only imagine what it's like in North Dakota.
It guided me through the Iraq War. It was liberal talk radio.
Oh, liberal talk radio.
So
sorry.
It was sports, but it was sports talk, but they were these old liberals in Minneapolis, KFAN.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Casual Friday. We've got a lot to get to. Alex Perrine will be here. We don't have a second guest. We want to get to the phones quicker. Quick. We're going to talk about Breyer. We have a clip. Before we get to that, though, I want to talk about this this story about the leases. This is really exciting. Maybe it's not that exciting, but it just goes to show you the importance of who gets to fill the federal judiciary. We're going to be talking about the Supreme Court. But there are hundreds of other federal judges. The Biden administration has put 45, I believe it is, maybe 42 federal judges on the bench. Those are lifetime appointments. They did so in the fastest amount of time that we've seen that many judges put on the bench. There's another 40 that have already been nominated, so they're in the pipeline. The Dick Durbin, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has followed his Republican counterpart's lead from when they had the majority, which is to ignore blue slips. Patrick Leahy, he did not do this. He reinstated blue slips. Blue slips are just basically these chits that the home senators have when you're appointing a judge in a district or a circuit, I should say. The senators from that state, just as a Senate tradition, because how can we make this even more less democratic than it is, could say, I don't like that judge, and I'm not going to give you my blue slip. And even though it was not even a rule, it's just a tradition. After the Republicans had refused to honor blue slips, Patrick Leahy reinstated it because he wanted Senate comity. And then Durbin, when he became chair of the judiciary, he's ignoring those. Good for him. One other precedent set by the Republicans, they're batch confirming these people now. So you're seeing four or five judges being confirmed at a time. This judge, Rudolph Contreras, U.S. District Court Judge for the District of Columbia, is an Obama appointee from 2012. He canceled the oil and gas leases of more than 80 million acres in the Gulf of Mexico. You'll recall that when Joe Biden campaigned in 2020, he said that he was going to stop drilling on federal lands, period, he said when he was in New Hampshire. Shortly after office, he signed an executive order to pause the issuing of the leases. Then, Republican attorney generals from 18 states sued. Federal judge in Louisiana blocked that order and ruled that the administration must hold the lease sales in the Gulf that had already been scheduled. Now, the administration could have tried to play hardball here. And by hardball, I don't mean that they would have said something. They could have just not done it.
Yeah, there had to be like this auction process by which the leases could be distributed to the people who are going to do the drilling. And the Biden administration could have just been like, yeah, we're going to hold that in.
Right. We have scheduling problems
30,
or 55, whatnot.
55, yeah.
And now, at that point, Deb Haaland would have supposedly been held in contempt. However, environmental groups countersued, and they said that the way that the Interior Department under the Trump administration was assessing whether these federal lands were eligible to be leased for oil and gas exploration or drilling was outdated. And so the lawsuit alleged that additional drilling in the Gulf would not increase greenhouse gas emissions based upon the measure in which they used it. Like, apparently they just would, like, do you see any? No? Okay, then there's not there, or something to that effect. The analysis did not include, according to these environmental groups who sued, new information about the impact of offshore drilling on rising global temperatures. And the judge said in his ruling that the Interior Department acted arbitrarily and capriciously in excluding foreign consumption from their greenhouse gas emission. In other words, you can't decide, well, it's not going to raise greenhouse emission because we're going to sell this gas. It doesn't make any sense.
Don't you know it greenhouse gas emissions, they can't cross the wall.
Yeah. No, they're not American. So it was required to do so under the 1970 National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, says the government must consider ecological damage when deciding whether to permit drilling and construction projects. Now, theoretically, the Biden administration, it seems to me, could have had Deb Haaland run this. I mean, we saw all the stuff, that the foot dragging that we saw with the Keystone XL pipeline to work in the other direction. They could have done it this way. They didn't, and a federal judge has basically enjoined it.
And I
should say, though, this is sad. This part is sad, and let me do this. Scott Lauerman, spokesman for the American Petroleum Institute, which represents oil and gas companies, said in a statement, "We're reviewing this disappointing decision, considering our options. Offshore energy development plays a critical role in strengthening our nation's economy and energy security." So,
it pays me.
And coincidentally pays
me. He left that part out.
Exhibit number 5,010,000,000 of why judges are so important. So important. I mean, frankly, it remains to be seen if they'll pass anything from the Build Back Better. Pramila Jayapal seems to be aware of what Manchin has signed off on and wants to just pass those things and do other stuff extant. Things like universal pre-K. A couple other things I don't have right in front of me.
Yeah, I wrote it down. $550 billion in climate provisions. He's in favor of the elder care parts, according to her, the child care, the universal pre-K, all that kind of stuff. But no of child tax credit, of course. That's done.
All right. And so, you know, those things in themselves, material benefits to people, get them passed. But beyond that, it is quite clear that the Senate is not going to allow any type of major legislation beyond if that. And so the real reason to hold the Senate, the reason why it's so crucial, far more crucial than holding both houses at this point with Manchin and Sinema there, is because of Biden's ability to appoint judges. That is it. Let's play this clip from one of the all-time great narcissists. Also, there was a great piece that Matt Stoller wrote in his Substack Big that was complaining that people were wearing masks everywhere. No, that's not it. That was about Stephen Breyer's antitrust issues, problems. And hopefully that will be helpful to get him off the court. But the biggest issue is this guy was an incredible narcissist. It is still precarious. But here is, you know what? Let's save this for Alex. We'll do this when Alex comes. Just want to remind you, this program is sponsored by one of my favorite sponsors, Sunset Lake Sabade.
Gets weirder every time.
I know it does. I get more excited about it. Use the coupon code.
Blah, blah.
It's like a catchphrase.
Now. Left is best. 20% off. You can go there and you get there. First off, they have a whole new line of flavored tinctures, and they have the 6,000 milligram bottle, which gives you a much bigger dose of CBD and is incredibly helpful for me, anyways, for sleeping. I still use the salve on my legs for whatever reason when I get eczema, but I'm starting to use it for for dry skin. I never use any dry skin products, and I only do this, is going to sound weird, on my calves.
Uh-huh. Well, we know your calves are a precious commodity.
They're the only place that I get dry skin. And
I've been using that lotion.
They have the hemp lotion, too.
I've been using it. Well, I get dry skin, you know, like all over. So I've been using that, and it's and it smells so good, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you also have edibles in the form of gummies and fudge. There's also smokables that are... I'm not gonna lie. I've been hitting the pre-rolls quite a bit lately. I can't quite tell the difference between like the special sauce one and this and that, but it's a nice finish to, you know, me having a little too much to drink occasionally. They're great products, and there's a tremendous amount of integrity both in the product. You can see third party analysis of what's in there. You also we'll be glad to know they have great business practices. $15 minimum wage, mostly employee-owned company. They have donated thousands of dollars to things like strike funds to give directly. They gave over $10,000 in that promotion that we did a month or two ago. Wow. I can't remember even any time. But food banks, they do a lot of work in their community. Just a great company all around. Sunset Lake Sebade. .com. Check it out right now. Okay, now, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome back to the program the proprietor of the AP Substack, Alex Perrine, staff writer at the New Republic, co-host of the Politics of Everything. What's your co-host's name again?
Laura Marsh.
Laura Marsh. Yeah, I just somehow I just started following her on Twitter. But a great read. That is not her. Alex, welcome to the show. Where Emma's here, obviously, as you can tell.
Yeah.
Hi, Sam and Emma.
Did you get rid of your beard?
Did I get rid of it? No, I got it. I trimmed it. It's trimmer than last you saw, perhaps. Yours is looking good, by the way.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
That was the whole purpose of that.
Yeah, no. It's total thirst.
That's why
trap.
You brought it up.
Yeah. I just want to I want to talk about your let's start with Breyer, but I do want to get to your piece because I thought that was such a good piece that you wrote about what's going on with COVID. But I want to talk about Breyer because this is obviously like at the end of the day, the one thing that Joe Biden has delivered more than your typical Democratic president, at least in the modern era, is a slate of federal judges that I think out of the 40, I think something like a third of them were public defenders.
Yeah.
There's still a couple of corporatists in there, but we have a diversity, not just from, you know, socioeconomic, you know, to the extent that you can have that diversity, I guess, amongst, you know, potential picks for that, but also in terms of race and ethnicity, but more almost, you know, more important to me is the type of law that's being practiced. Meanwhile, here is, but let's just start with Stephen Breyer making his announcement. I just want to get a rating from you on the narcissism scale where this guy is. Here is Justice Stephen Breyer, you know, announcing his retirement. See if you can see like an image of his book in the background.
He meant women too. And we are now engaged in a great civil war to determine whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. God. See, those are the words I want. To see an experiment. And that's what he thought. It's an experiment. And I found some letters that George Washington wrote where he said the same thing. It's an experiment.
Who cares?
That experiment existed then because even the liberals in Europe, you know, they're looking over here and they're saying it's a great idea in principle, but it'll never work. But we'll show them it does. That's what Washington thought. And that's what Lincoln thought. And that's what people still think today. And I say, well, I want you, and I'm talking to the students now. I say, I want you to pick just this up. It's an experiment that's still going on. And I'll tell you something. You know who will see whether that experiment works? It's you, my friend. It's you, Mr. High School student. It's you, Mr. College student. It's you, Mr. Law School students. It's us, but it's you. It's that next generation and the one after that. My grandchildren and their children. They'll determine whether the experiment still works. And of course, I am an optimist, and I'm pretty sure it will. Does it surprise you that that's the thought that comes into my mind today? I don't know. But thank you.
Now, we should say two things strike me there. He started that yesterday. He's still talking.
Uh-huh.
Also, apparently, the future, going to be all male again.
Yeah.
Mr. High School student, Mr. Cobb. But this guy, my God, he waited till his book came out.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. I mean, it's great. It's great publicity, right?
Oh, yeah. Is there any fundamental difference between that kind of person who fetishizes like the founding fathers and the American way of governance to that degree and his own place in it for that matter, and like an adult who's just really obsessed with like Harry Potter or something like that? I mean, the commitment to the fanciful notions of our republic, it's childlike to me. And yet, and of course, like it him being a part of it is helpful in that regard. And when we're talking about his narcissism,
I mean, this is the background to a lot of debates we have over the last several years, especially escalating since Trump, is that sort of older liberals' attachment to elementary school civics version of American life.
Mm-hmm.
Which I as a person who grew up and who became an adult in the post 9/11 era, I've never been able to relate to it at all. And I can't imagine, I have to imagine it just sounds like a foreign language to people younger than me. So I don't know. I mean, Breyer is exceptional in his attachment to it and that he's like one of the most preening, self-regarding versions of it imaginable. But it's like, it's definitely something that has a strong hold over all the people in his generation who refuse to let go of power.
And the amazing thing, like, you know, we have two types of those, two categories of those two types of people you're talking about. Like, you know, the idea that at least, you know, he's sort of recognizing or there are people who could have this sort of, you know, well, I don't know, his vision of this experiment and that type of language and that type of belief, you know. There's some people who are, you know, would argue like it is under grave, grave threat right now. And I am sort of, you know, depending on what day I can at the very least understand that. And I think there's an argument, you know, because I don't know. I've never lived through the demise of, you know, and I think to the extent that we have a democracy, it is highly problematic and flawed insofar as how well it functions. But in terms of like, you know, that Canadian professor who was around saying that, you know, in 10 years, America is probably going to be an autocracy of some form. Like, it doesn't sound crazy to me.
Right.
Because I've never lived through this process before, and I don't know what it would look like. But I can't imagine it would look dramatically different than this. It's just who knows, you know, sometimes you just don't know how deep a pond is until you start to walk in it.
That's exactly right. And the fact is, so there's, I think, two things here. And one of them is that when you talk about America as an experiment, okay, so when can we make a determination that we want to change the parameters of the experiment? We can't. Like, can we add seats to the Supreme Court? Can we get rid of the Senate? If we say these aspects of the experiment aren't working out, well, it turns out the people in charge aren't going to let us change them.
Exactly.
And then the other part of it is, in the already existing system, you know, Wisconsin is not a democracy. We have a federalist system. People are already living under undemocratic governments all across the country. So again, like, how's the experiment going? Who gets to decide when the experiment is done? Who actually gets to judge it besides Justice Breyer's children?
And he gets, and he's gotten to decide a lot about what the makeup of the American experiment has been over the many decades that he's been a judge and that he's been on the Supreme Court. And there is this quality to justices and many judges as well of being so sequestered from the actual realities of everyday people that, one, the nature of having a lifetime appointment allows for that, but also, two, their perception of themselves is above the fray in that area, and academics who can see these things from their lofty ivory towers in their robes, I mean, that is part of the issue as well, and I mean, it could be solved by ending lifetime appointments and then also adding and ending judicial review in many ways.
The, so. I know you grew up, raised by lawyers. I was too. And one of the things that I have found to be sort of just impossible to absorb with this generation of lawyers in particular. Is their sort of belief. I mean, Breyer's talking as if this experiment is just we put these things out there into this laboratory and then we stand back and we just observe as if he's not actively involved in the experiment. Like, this is not an experiment. It's like, I'm going to pour these two things in there and stand back and see what happens. Like, there are 9 people in this country who have the ability to fundamentally change the relationship between our government and citizens. And they do it more or less to some degree every day. Mm-hmm. And he is sitting next to a couple of them, 6 of them, maybe you could argue 5, depending on any given day, who are just completely ignoring every sort of fantasy that he has or maintains or pretends exists in the law. This idea that the law is above the fray and that you can be.
Yeah.
It's
religious.
It's about being. It's totally a religion.
Yeah, I was totally triggered by the way he spoke like
that. Yes. And it's totally a. Like, you know, we're part of this priesthood and it's an avocation and. The law exists distinct from human influence. Mm-hmm. And it's like, dude, look across the people next to you and tell me that's the truth. I mean, it's just absurd. And it's almost like he held on to this fiction so that he could sell his fucking book. And, and we are still in a tremendous amount of jeopardy. Now, I should be clear here. If the Senate were to confirm somebody tomorrow, even though Breyer's not stepping down, once that person is confirmed, this is my understanding, they are confirmed. Mm-hmm. So even if they confirm tomorrow, they won't, obviously, and, I don't know, Patrick Leahy passes on because he's old or somebody gets hit by a bus in the Democratic, whatever it is, and is appointed by a Republican, their successor is appointed by a Republican governor, or their successor is not named, which is also a possibility, right? Because how do you pass in a 50-50 Senate if you only have 49 senators? So there's a lot of jeopardy involved here that this guy just was like, but I think it's going to work.
It's the grand experiment.
I think it's going to work.
Yeah. He timed it. It's really close to the last possible minute that he could have done this with the understanding that the majority could very well be lost by the end of the year. I guess it's very hard to let go of these, myths once you allow them to become sort of foundation of your entire worldview. But at the end of the day, you know, he's retiring while Democrats can replace him. And I don't even know how we're supposed to like square that with what he's telling us, right? How does he square it to himself?
Yes. Yeah. Well, and we should be more explicit because he was adamant 6 to 9 months ago that he would not retire for political.
There'd be no political considerations in his retirement. Right. So
it really is.
He should have at least pretended to have gotten sick or something, right? Just to like, just to try to make it a little clearer. Well, like, coughing a little blood coming out of his mouth.
And that's part of the narcissism. I mean, not to hang on this too much, but the perception that one is above politics in the saintly position that one resides in, when you are in politics, you are in it. And the fiction that they hold on to, one of the many that drives me nuts, is that there is a way for these Supreme Court justices to look upon politics beneath them and then make these godlike decisions that affect everybody else because they have the ability to see what measly minded or meager minded politicians who are elected by the plebeians that they cannot see. And I find that to be, you know, triggering, as you say, as I said before. I hate it.
We should say just to be fair to lawyers, that there's some of this still resides in the Senate, and I think it's almost gone from the media. But, you know, you and I remember David Broder and that this sort of supposed mentality. But the fact of the matter is that depending on where you're situated, even if you genuinely believe this stuff, if you look around what's happening in this country, you are aiding and abetting that which you say your inaction or your being above the fray is actually part of the fray. There's no escaping it.
And what the Supreme Court and the Senate have in common as institutions is that, I think realists point to the results of their actions, and then the people in the institution say, like, don't do that. You are hurting the legitimacy of our institution in the eyes of the people. Don't stop. You are making us look illegitimate by pointing to the outcomes that our institutions create.
And so there we are. And Biden came out and said that he was going to appoint an African-American woman to this seat. There are a couple of, I guess, candidates that are perceived to be front runners. Ketanji Brown Jackson and Leandra Krueger seem to be the top two. Jackson is 51. Krueger is 45. Krueger is supposedly considered more moderate. I don't know what that means.
I saw she went to Yale and Harvard.
I think they both are well.
Some people are trying to like get the Biden administration to consider somebody not from an Ivy League law school. But
good luck with that.
How dare you suggest that someone in the esteemed institution of the Supreme Court didn't go to an Ivy League law school?
But it's going to be interesting. We've already seen Ed Whelan. He was the guy who said that Brett Kavanaugh had a doppelganger.
Right.
And
used like Zillow records and like developed this really elaborate and strange tale.
And of course, we know what Ed Whelan says because the New York Times interviewed him. Because apparently the guy who stands on the corner, just west of 42nd Street on a soapbox wearing, wearing a diaper and playing a guitar wasn't available. And so,
hey, it's a thong.
Yeah. What's interesting is to see how much of the I can't believe he's going to like make this pick based upon identity and politics we're going to see. I don't know if anybody's noticed, but Amy Coney Barrett, everyone knew that she would be picked. Everyone. And to be clear, she had never been a judge. She had been a judge for what, like a year and a half? Was that it?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, right? Because it's exactly what you say. Like the Republic, like the Federalist Society has a list of young far right Catholics that they pick from. Now everyone has to pretend to be sort of outraged at, Biden. I mean, it's funny when Biden just came out and said that because it's a little old fashioned, right? You could hear like Nixon or Reagan even just being like, I got to get a woman. We're going to put a woman on there. And then I feel like it was this sort of 90s, 2000s thing where you had to be like the best possible jurist, regardless of identity, you know? But now, you know, Biden's a throwback guy. So he's like, we're just going to do it.
Or you could just come out and say like, I'm going to figure out who I'm going to put on and then just put her on. Like, you don't have to, like, you just got to do it. You know, you don't need to, like, you know, nobody's owed the forewarning that you're going to do the right thing. And, you know, I mean, honestly, like, if it's hard for me to believe that there is one person out there who is the is the best pick for the Supreme Court. Like, I mean, give me a break.
It's very silly. I mean,
it's just absurd. It's absurd.
It's like the sword and the stone.
Yeah, exactly.
Again, that's part of, like, the fan fiction element of it too, right? Like the lofty way in which this entire process is perceived is so disconnected from the way the rest of us perceive it, especially in the post 9/11 era. And the rest of us have immense disdain for it, as the rest of them are, like, forgive me, masturbating to it. Well, you dropped the F-bomb in the first hour, so
I guess.
I felt the flood.
I forgive you for it, Emma.
Yeah. Thank you.
Sorry. I just found that. So, I mean, I had problems with Ginsburg staying on as long as she did. His was, in many ways, more reprehensible because he just had a very recent example of why you don't do that.
Exactly.
I mean, she was a little bit overconfident. He should have had the ability to look and go, like, oh, I guess that happens.
Yeah.
And realize, like, not a good idea. So hopefully this happens quickly and we get past it. But, you know, again, it's another one of those things. And not coincidentally, Nancy Pelosi announced that she's running for re-election again. Because it is so important that she's the only person who can do this. And the idea that, I mean, so much of our politics, at least in the context of the Democratic Party, are, it seems to me, trapped by this generation that will not step aside. And they
believe they're indispensable.
They believe they're indispensable and their views are completely ossified. And I say this as someone who feels that my views on some level are ossified. But theirs are completely ossified, and it's stunning. It really is.
I mean, it's, you know, I'm approaching being a middle-aged dad, and, like, people two generations ahead of me are still running things. I don't even know what to say at this point. And it's because, like, Nancy Pelosi has an entire sort of industry of people to whom she is indispensable, because they rely on her for their employment and their connections in the party and their power in the party. And they're the only ones that these people actually talk to every day, right? Like, these hangers on and longtime aides and, you know, former staffers. Like, it's an institution that tells these people, oh, you know, you're right, you can't step aside because who could possibly fill your shoes?
And it's quite clear to me. I mean, she had pledged that she was not going to stay in leadership. I can't imagine she wouldn't have retired if she was gonna if she was going to actually give up leadership. But it seems like this is just a function of Joe Crowley's not around anymore. I don't have anybody to replace me. I may need another year to usher in Hakeem Jeffries. Is basically or decide whether it's going to be him or not, or, you know, I don't know.
I think it's that. Right. She needs more time to figure out her successor, and her daughter didn't want to run, you know, or maybe her daughter, she just felt like needed more time for her daughter to, like, get ready to run. Cause I'm nearly positive that is who is going to run to replace her.
Oh my God. Oh my God. honestly, like, I can't
even begin to think about that, or I'll get depressed.
let's just talk briefly before we get to your piece. Where we are in terms of the legislation, Joe Biden today, you know, you could see the turn from everybody, and word went down from high above, like, maybe we should start talking about the things that we've done, on some level, because it doesn't look like we're going to be doing much more. Pramila Jayapal apparently came out, and if Pramila Jayapal knows what Joe Manchin likes and dislikes in the Build Back Better, I would imagine there's a lot of other people who do too. I don't get the sense that, like,
you're close.
That mansion's like, listen, Pramila, I'm going to tell you.
And only telling you. I only trust you with this information.
I'm going to share you this with. But she, it sounds like, basically said, like, you guys have known this for a couple of weeks. Let's get this done so that we can do something. Because this hanging in the wind thing is just ridiculous. I don't know. Do you have any sense of where we go from here? Because it seems like the administration is being relentless in not having Biden do anything unilaterally at this point.
Yeah.
The whole party seems to be in complete defensive mode. They're already attempting to blame the left for their failure to even pass a moderate, the compromised version. Where are we in this as we are now 11 months out, 10 months out from midterms?
I think what is happening to some extent is that the administration is seeing their theory of politics disproven by events and simply does not know how to react. And I think in the sense that all the people involved thought that passing the bipartisan infrastructure bill would earn them a tremendous amount of goodwill from the press and the public that never materialized. And they were, I think, banking on this sense that they would get momentum from the bipartisan infrastructure bill, that COVID would disappear thanks to vaccines, and that they'd be coasting into the new year riding high. And when none of that happened, they just don't know what to say or do. And I think that's sort of where we are. I think that they're just like, oh, our original theory of politics that we could make the Senate work again turned out to be false. Our sort of backup theory that doing a big bipartisan thing would be popular didn't really mean much. And so I don't know. I think they're lost. I think they're just lost.
I can't help but think that the real, like, fundamental failure was with Biden inviting Republicans after the passage of the first COVID relief bill, of the only bill, relief bill they passed, inviting Republicans in, then inviting Sinema and Portman to develop their own, sort of dual track. And meanwhile, Chuck Schumer completely dropping the ball. Like,
yeah.
We were sold this idea of Joe Biden understands the Senate. Mm-hmm. And so he's going to take care of the Joe Manchin problem or any of those problems. And that there was actually a Senate majority leader who was in charge of this. I mean, this is an abject failure. If you cannot get your 50 senators to pass a piece of legislation that the biggest obstacle to, Joe Manchin, had called for a piece of legislation that was $500 billion bigger.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, initially he was saying $4 trillion. Like, they F this up or no point in having leadership. Like, it's either one or the other. Either this is why you need good leadership, or there's no such thing as leadership, and it's just like wherever the chips fall is where they fall.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like when you go back to what Manchin was saying, right? Like, you then have to think, like, if they had hurried this through without trying the because you could argue even at the time the bipartisan invite the Republicans to the White House thing was just a media game or a game to get Manchin on board. Like, I think that they were realistic enough to know there wouldn't be Republican votes for this. But when you had Manchin at that time being much more willing to play ball, I don't know why it took so long. Like, why it then stalled very quickly.
Because it was stupid. Because they thought, like, we're going to be able to do this without any pain whatsoever. You know, and, like, as if the Republicans, first of all, they were talking about Dr. Seuss in the wake of the COVID relief bill.
Yeah.
People forget that. That was the story for 3 weeks.
They were scrambling to try to find something.
And they thought, like, oh, if we pass this without any, without any sort of, like, attempt public attempt to bring the Republicans on board, people are going to say that we're just too much of a bully. And it's just unbelievable that was what they were working. It's like,
I mean, we've talked about this before, but senators, lifelong senators especially, they see that people hate dysfunction and people say they like bipartisanship. And then they think, well, we have to pursue bipartisanship. But we're like, what people like is winning, passing things, doing things. And what they don't like is squabbling, bickering, endless negotiations. And then the Senate chooses that path every single time. But like, just doing stuff. Like, people see, they're doing stuff. They don't really actually then notice or care how it got done.
It honestly is like the Titanic sinking. We've got to patch the hull. But first, we got to make sure it's the right color of blue that we paint the outside on, because we don't want to show up at back at the dock and people going like,
people don't like ugly boats.
The boat looks ugly. Oh, what happened?
People like their boats to be pretty. That's what our polling tells us.
All right. So, I mean, that's I don't know what else to say. I hope that they pass, universal pre-K, it's a big deal. Elder care. I'm not sure exactly what the provisions are. It's a big deal. Obviously, we have desperate need for some type of climate mitigation. I don't know if that's going to be even remotely close to what is enough, but something is better than nothing at this stage. But let's talk about the other thing that's going on, because I think you're right. I think they got completely blindsided by Omicron.
Yeah.
I think they thought that the vaccine was basically going to get things done. They attempted the vaccine mandate that got reversed, but largely I think it was successful because it was instituted, it created the right pressures to get people vaccinated at that time. But there is this, there's like almost like three tiers of this, right? Like there's the full-on anti-vaxxers, the sort of like Republican right-wing COVID deniers, and then there's this sort of like libertarian strain of denial that is trying to get everybody back to normal and out of this autocratic boot on our necks that is keeping normalcy. And you wrote a great piece on this, which basically said like, there's no foot in that boot. In fact, there's no boot.
Yeah. Yeah.
That last cohort of people are really libertarian in some way, because they're looking for some return to normalcy, it seems to me. Because they don't want government action to support a non-normal situation, but it's also just sort of bizarre.
Yeah. We just finished taping interviews for a forthcoming episode of our podcast, Politics is Everything, about Boris Johnson and his scandal in the UK. And we were talking to people in England, and one guest said something that was like, as I'm sure you are also used to there, we haven't been able to gather with family for some time. And I would encourage Americans to go look at what the restrictions, the government imposed restrictions, have been in Conservative Party run England over the last several years, because that is what actual restrictions on behavior look like. For a long time, they weren't allowed to go outside after like 10 p.m. They weren't allowed to gather in groups larger than five or six. And the authorities were enforcing them. Police were stopping cars to check where you were traveling and things like that. To go back to what I wrote about, I had sort of just described, first of all, my week, basically, in which my kid had gone to pre-K. We had a birthday party in the park. My mother visited for his birthday last week. And all of this happened in the background of thousands and thousands of Americans dying every day from COVID-19. And my essential point was that there aren't restrictions on behavior. I can go to I could go to a bar right now. I could go to a restaurant right now. And this is in New York, which had some of the stricter lockdown rules earlier in the pandemic. And sort of what people are debating and what they're complaining about is school closures to a large extent. But schools are closing mostly when people get sick. People get sick and they can't go to work, and then schools close. And I don't mean to diminish how difficult school closures are, because I know they have been impossible for a lot of parents to manage, especially working class parents. But working class and often Black parents are the ones who have been most in favor, sorry, of COVID mitigation and remote learning and virtual learning. Like, polls have consistently shown that. So I was sort of trying to sort of get around the more tedious part of that debate, but also just to sort of emphasize to Americans that, like, the government is not currently telling you can't do things, you know, especially like once you get the vaccine.
And to the extent that, the mandate was the so-called vaccine mandate that the Biden administration pushed was supposedly, I mean, it wasn't really a vaccine mandate. It was a testing mandate, which you could opt out of. Mm-hmm. I mean, my experience has been exactly like yours. To the extent that I see, like, you know, restaurants having problems or this and that, it is not because the government has in any way inhibited people from going to the restaurant. It's that concern about COVID has, and it's like there's this cohort of people out there. Matt just sent me Nate Silver's tweet. Let's put it up blind, because I'm sure it's going to be indicative of this. I mean, look, I think, you know,
Open Table restaurant reservation.
Oh yeah, this is it. Yeah. In Miami, they were up 14% compared with January of 2019, but other places they were down dramatically. I guess the argument is that somehow, there's more restrictions there. No, I think what it is that there are people in those areas, in those blue areas, who are taking it more seriously. I would also bet on some level, I mean, it has to do with, like, in Manhattan, for instance, I'm looking at that down 64%. It's because you had really wealthy people going to their places in the East Hamptons, or going to Colorado.
Palm Beach. Yeah.
Maybe that's why they're up in Florida, because they want to be outside more. I would also imagine there's more outside dining in Miami.
It would be nicer to be outdoor dining in Miami right now than it would here.
Absolutely. I mean, to think that that's not a part of this equation, it is much, much safer to eat outside than it is inside. And the other thing is that I find astonishing about this is that, you know, as a parent, that the idea that you could in some way, even if you know statistically the odds are low, and I'm not saying that they necessarily are, frankly, particularly with Omicron, of your kid getting seriously ill from anything that you did or didn't do, the stakes are so much higher, even if the statistics aren't there. And so it inhibits your behavior.
Yeah.
And that is a perfectly rational, and I would think on some level, you know, an attribute that we want from parents. Be somewhat overly protective of your kids in light of, you know, not knowing what long COVID is in, you know, how it's going to implicate kids years down the road. I mean, I can see that. I mean, I can see why people would, you know, I wouldn't necessarily have been the first person in line with my 8-year-old to get vaccinated. After a couple million people get vaccinated, all right, I feel a little more comfortable about it. But, I mean, so I can understand, you know, like that, you know, some measure of concern to do anything with your kid. I mean,
my kid just turned 5, right? So he only just became vaccine eligible. And there are things that I think we have been not as cautious as some people, but we've been reasonably cautious. But there are things we weren't doing until we could get the vaccine for him. And I have to imagine, like, that's not a sign. When other people are doing that, it's not irrational, and it's not because they are in love with lockdown, right? And that's sort of the language that I find most off-putting, because I don't know anyone for whom that's true. I know people who are being cautious according to their own calculations of their safety based on their best understanding of public health. And we need better public health communication, certainly, in addition to all sorts of other kinds of support. But, you know, like, there were, I'm not doing the sort of up until he's fully immune, like, we're not doing the sort of travel we would have been doing in a normal year. And, like, that's just because of the reality of the world. Also, when we took him to get his shot, he was very, very worried about getting vaccinated. And he said, instead of getting the vaccine, can I just get a shot? And we said, yes, you can. If you want to, you can just get a shot.
No, he's gonna hold that against you when he finds out. I mean, my son was, you know, and it was certainly wasn't coming from us. He was very relieved to get the vaccine. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I don't know. I agree with you. Like, the idea of, like, somebody's in love with the lockdown is just a bizarre construct. And it's almost as if, I mean, the analogy I would make is this, is that, like, if in the course of doing everything I can to protect my children within what I deem to be reasonable, and everybody has their own, like you say, everybody has their own sort of, like, comfort zone with that. And I, you know, as a matter of policy, I think people should do that. I might, you know, be sitting and talking on the phone with somebody and say, like, I can't believe they're doing this or that. But as a matter of policy, you know, like, in terms of the public, but we do what's within reason. And then maybe we do stuff that we're willing to accept that risk. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes us feel comfortable. It's as if these people want to do stuff and want to not have to account the deaths or whatever's happening.
Or because, feel like a bad parent because
but other they're not people, parents.
Right.
Like, that's the thing. Or, it's like the people who are espousing this generally are not parents. It's as if they have this, like, I want to be able to say this stuff and not have it have myself feel guilty as I see thousands of people a day dying.
Yeah.
It's just
and that's why the unmask our children thing is so so much of that is projection too, right?
Totally.
It's because they want to go to bars, they want to do whatever they want to do, and they don't want to feel like they want to be protected from any guilt that happens from that. And that
I think it's totally normal to just have a very powerful feeling of, I want everything to go back to the way it was. I often feel that way. I would like everything to just go back to the way it was. And I think what these people we're talking about have done is they've turned that feeling and they've taken that feeling and they turned it into someone else's fault. You know, like, they've said everyone else has decided not to allow things to be the way they were.
Yeah.
And that's just not really the fact.
But this is also very, it seems to me, very much related to the whole cancel culture argument, which is why I don't think it's a coincidence that a lot of these people are the same people who are talking about this stuff, because it is a resent that they are not getting permission to have the world be, to perceive the world as if, A, they need permission from everybody else because they want to be released from any type of accountability for their perspective. And so they're projecting onto others that you're inhibiting my feeling of freedom. And my freedom is not just freedom in terms of, like, what I can do or what I can say, but freedom from any type of doubt creeping in. And for years, my argument about what Rush Limbaugh did more than anything else for the conservative mind was to say, and he would explicitly say this at different stages in his career, do not doubt yourself. Mm-hmm. Do not doubt yourself. It was all about any creeping doubt that would come in is to be expelled. And that's what these people are arguing for. Do not make me feel any doubt about this.
It's a powerful and attractive thing. And I think, like, we've seen its success on the right and the center right. Like, it's liberatory.
And it's very much libertarian on some level too, because if you, the other option is, hey, we need to accept that the virus exists And how do we respond to this in such a way that is going to minimize immiseration for people? Government needs to spend a tremendous amount of money to allow people to stay at home, to pay for mechanisms in which to take care of kids, to increase, you know.
You're worried about the restaurants? Give them aid.
Exactly.
You're worried about the restaurants? Give them aid, Nate Silver.
And you're worried about you know, children's ability to socialize and whatnot. Put high powered ventilators into, the ventilation into schools. Like, fit the schools to make them even more safe.
Yeah.
If you're that worried about it, there should be filters in every classroom. Really good filters, multiple filters. Mm-hmm. You should be able to, you know, spend the money. It would be an incredibly expensive project, but apparently,
this is the sad thing is that we sent a bunch of money out to do that, but with no mechanism to say this is how the money should be spent, no ability to follow up and say here's where that school money should have gone. And so a lot of the times it just disappeared into other stuff because we have a barely functional government.
Yeah. Well, Alex Preen, glad we figured all that out.
Same, as always.
Yes, always a pleasure. So wait, is this episode that you did on Boris Johnson? You know, it also reminds me, too. I just want to say this because this also stuck in my craw. There are some leftists out there that I respect who are against the vaccine mandates. Again, we have no vaccine mandates in this country except for healthcare workers. Mm-hmm. There's this clip going around of Jeremy Corbyn, where ostensibly he's against vaccine mandates. And if you listen to the clip carefully, you will see that his problem with vaccine mandates was basically twofold. One, he didn't see it as practical because the NHS was going to lose a significant portion of its healthcare workers. That was not an issue in this country.
Yeah.
It was almost like a Y2K type of situation. This apocalypse that we thought was going to happen in terms of vaccinations and they would be understaffed. That's not what's causing a strain in our hospitals. It's the fact that you had people, you know, inhibiting any type of COVID protective measures to protect the hospitals. A and B.
And we have a for-profit healthcare system that like makes sure that there's very, very little margin for
no
error.
Slack.
Yeah.
No slack. Mm-hmm. And the other thing was that Corbyn had mentioned was like, it's better to to convince people than force people. And the fact of the matter is we can measure that. And in this country, when the administration said, we're going to impose either a test mandate with an exemption for vaccines, it worked.
Yeah. Yeah.
It worked. It added, it gave us a bump in vaccinations.
Well, and, you know, all this anti-mandate stuff is coming at a time where the West is trying to convince China to drop their zero COVID rules, which kept their rates so low throughout this entire thing that they've actually had a more voluntary vax system than we have. But we're trying to get them to drop that now because we need them to get back in the factories and making stuff for the supply chain.
Exactly.
So that's why these libertarians, like, they likes to act like we're the anti-authoritarian one, but really you're just saying what the West is saying to China.
Exactly. So wait. So when?
Our Boris episode will be up next week. You'll be able to see it.
Okay, and folks can check that out. The politics of everything. Alex Preen, thanks so much for your time. Always a pleasure.
Of course. See you later.
Thanks, Alex. Bye.
All right, folks. We're gonna head into the fun half. Early fun half this week. In the fun half, we got a lot of clips. We're gonna take your phone calls because we got
fun,
in there
fun,
quick.
Fun.
We're going to take your IMs. We're going to debate another person who believes that the squad is bringing you fascism.
I loathe Joking. To give you a compliment, Joking. But you're consistently so on point with that thing about Limbaugh and the doubt.
It's just like I listen to him and, well, I don't know why you're loathe to give me a compliment, but... But I know I listened to him. I listened to him for many, many, many years, and I was always struck. There, he went through a period of time, and I can't remember when it was. Maybe it was like in the mid '90s to the mid aughts, but it really was in the '90s where his show was. It wasn't quite how to, but there was a quality of like self help there, where a lot of time was dedicated towards that notion of, you know, don't doubt yourself. do not doubt yourself, which is, you know, good in some contexts, but really problematic in others. And what he was basically saying was shut out all information, not just that I'm giving you, but any information that makes you doubt whether your positions are, whether you and people like you own the truth. Mm-hmm. And that was very, very important.
It's why cults try to remove people from their families and support systems.
And within the concern, I mean, look at, how many times have we talked about, you know, the dynamic of someone's conservative on certain positions until it happens to their family?
Yeah.
And that's what that dynamic is about. Oh. Because you can't shut it out when your kid all of a sudden wants to get, you know, wants to live a normal life and get married. You know, even though they're gay. It's much harder for you as a parent to sort of like ignore that. Oh, wait a second. Maybe it's possible that these things exist, you know, outside of me. Or, you know, we see it with the vaccinations. I mean, we see it over and over again. And there's plenty of examples. But, oh, and before we go, ladies and gentlemen, this is, I have a special, special announcement. Special shofar. Dorsey, who has been, who is actually the first producer this show ever had.
Wow.
There was really, at its beginning, two people who made the show possible. Kyle, when he came to me and said, like, I will construct your tech. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God, maybe it's possible to do this. I ran into Dorsey on the street. And you know, he had, we knew each other from Air America. And he's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I don't know. I may do this show. And he's like, I'll help you. And I'm like, yeah, but I mean, I don't, I mean, I could barely pay you anything. Like, there's not going to be any revenue. And he's like, I'll help you. And I was like, oh, okay. And, so, like, I think for the first, I don't know how many months it was, 4 or 5 months. And then he got a real job at BuzzFeed, but he launched the show. And then he came back, when we were, you know, years later. Well, Dorsey just had his, just scored a coup. And this is Dorsey and Maddie are now officially engaged.
Oh. Yeah. Congrats
so
to
congratulations,
him.
Well, to Dorsey and to Maddie.
And to Maddie.
I mean, probably more to Dorsey.
Right.
But to both of them equally. I don't want to make a judgment on that. I'm not trying to imply.
I mean, you did, but that's okay.
I guess I did. But congratulations, you guys. Very, very happy for you. All right. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, the AM Quickie. I just checked the numbers. It has grown by like 20% in the past like 3 or 4 months. People are really loving it. You get top news stories every day by Jack or Corey. They switch off. And we don't sell your email addresses. You're not going to get like, you know, crypto pitches or gold pitches or even, you know, CBD pitches. We're going to occasionally put an ad in the newsletter itself, but you're not going to get emails from anybody else but us. And you're always going to get some content that you want to read. So check it out. amquickie.com. Sign up. It's free. We may go to some model because at one point we're going to have to make some money off it. But that's always the last thing I figure out.
Yeah.
But it's free and it's a great read every day. amquickie.com. Check it out. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian Media Universe?
Yeah, for patrons of Left Reckoning this weekend, we have Kevin Bird at the Bird Maniac on Twitter. He's an actual scientist, a radical scientist, but he publishes on a plant or he's a PhD student in plant genome biology. Talking about this new book on biological determinism, genetic determinism that's come out and has usual types trying to say, you know, we need to think really long and hard about what genetics mean for social justice. And a lot of the wokes are overlooking it because of political correctness. It turns out that, again, not really the case. And so we dive deep into that and also get into Stephen Jay Gould and the radical scientist who met this sort of the race science, race IQ science challenge head on in the 70s and 80s. So that is a really good interview. So all you science nerds, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
Gould was so great. He was really the only scientist as a kid that I would like read because I was like, he was so accessible.
He's great leftist, and I didn't know.
I don't think I knew that when I would read him.
Right, I knew Gould was cool. I didn't know the degree of what he was like an ideological leftist. And I didn't know there was a whole sort of milieu of folks like that.
I had no idea
that were against like nuclear proliferation and stuff like that. So
I just read him because I felt like he's a scientist, but I can understand what he's talking about.
He's a Hall of Famer. Yeah.
646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.